Hey, this is Bootstrapped Web. We are back for another episode today. And you know what? We're going to try something new. And we kind of mentioned this on last week's episode, but you know, Jordan and I have been talking about mixing things up here on Bootstrapped Web and inviting, you know, a bunch of our friends into the show and maybe have some recurring guests over the next couple of weeks and just try to open it up today. So today for our first of these guests is Ian Landsman. You know, Ian, good to have you on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on. This is great to be the guinea pig here on this slightly modified format.
Definitely yeah. Modified. It's our first psychedelic adventure into the unknown.
That's right. And, you know, we've had guests on before, but I think those were probably geared more as like interviews. And that's really, you know, not necessarily what we're going for here. You know, we're just going to kind of do conversations like we always do, but just bring in some of our friends so that it's not just me and Jordan rambling on every single week.
Yes.
And I was on this show pre-Jordan.
Pre-J.
So oh, that's right.
I was the internet. I was the interview.
I would call it BJ, but that doesn't seem right.
Yeah. Not cute PG.
Nice. Well, Brian had a good suggestion so that we're not wandering aimlessly in the desert. So that we're at least pointed toward an oasis in said desert. And that's to have an overall theme to just start off as a start off point.
I like it.
Yeah. Brian, what are we talking about here? Where are we starting things?
So what I put down for today was just the long game and whatever that means, whether it's, you know, just building a business for the long term rather than just a short term play, making decisions. And we'll just kind of bat that around, like how we're all thinking about the long game. And I guess the reason why this idea came up when I saw that you signed up for today's episode, Ian, I was thinking about you and your business. For those who aren't familiar, you know, you run Userscape. I mean, why don't you, not to make this a total interview thing, but why don't you give people a quick intro?
Come on, everybody who listens to my podcast listens to your podcast. But probably. Yeah, so the nickel version is I run a company called Userscape. Our main product's called HelpSpot, which you might be more likely to have heard of. It's a help desk app, and we started in, I guess, like I kind of started coding it in 2004, but we launched in like late 2005. So it's been about 11 years we've been selling it. And and that's a good topic because I started out, I did not start out with any long game. I started out as like replace my salary. And that was the only thing I considered. And this was, you know, 2005, 2004. It's way before.
It's crazy. Like, right after .com. Did they have the internet back then?
Right. I know. It's like, it feels like that sometimes. And all the, well, especially the tech and stuff and all the cool stuff the kids play with these days. But yeah, no, it was crazy. Like you couldn't get money. Like there's no money to be had anywhere or anything. So it was just like, how am I going to make, you know, $55,000 a year? Like that's what I need to do.
And or the goal.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what we did and saved up money and gave it a shot. And that was back when it was hard to work on the side on it. So we worked on it. Like I quit my job to build it and just like on a hope and a prayer kind of thing.
Who's we?
Me and my wife. My wife kept working and she had a good job. And so she kind of sugar daddied us. And then eventually she was able to leave her job and we both worked on the company. But yeah, in the beginning it was just like, oh, I guess I'll quit my job and see how it goes. I'll get another job, I guess, if this doesn't work out.
Anything is possible with a supportive wife.
Yeah, no, that's like, I mean, it would have been like impossible.
That's very true.
Without it. It's kind of cool because it's like that, it's like having a part, it's kind of like a partnership, like having a partner in the business, which is great. And on the flip side, it's also a negative because like she doesn't hold down the fort when I go on vacation. Like we're both going on vacation together. And so
Still together doing it?
We're still together doing it. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. That's, that could be a whole episode right there. It's a lot to that. She still works in the business and that's great. It'd be impossible still without her. So
how many times have you rewritten your code base?
You know, like none.
Really?
Yeah. So that's what we're actually just doing that now. So like year 11, we're like in the last big release, we started to get into that a little bit. And in this next major release, it's going to be a much larger chunk of it that's rewritten. But yeah, I know we've been so small. It's like, do I build features or do I rewrite this thing and make it cleaner and better? And it's like, I'm building features because that's like what sells software. So now, you know, it's painful when you get to a certain point. So it's definitely time to spend a little more time and now we're a little bit bigger. It's a little easier to spend a little more time on it. But yeah, it's always a tough call there.
Nice. You know, just thinking about like, you know, thinking long term about bootstrapping a business, right? I mean, obviously 11 years ago, you were just trying to replace your income going from a job to starting this thing. So like going into this without knowing what the future holds, were you thinking like, this is something that I'll try, or this product is one of a few different ideas that I'll throw at the wall and see where it goes? And like, did you have any expectation that you'd be spending at least the next 10, 11 years on it?
No, I don't think I ever thought that far out about it. Because also, again, in that like day and age, there wasn't really a lot of examples to go on. Like the internet before that was like Netscape and, you know, those kind of companies. And so there wasn't this idea of like, you're a person. I mean, it was just starting to form, right? Like this idea that you are one person and you're going to build some software that sells around the world and it's going to be like a real business. Like, so we didn't have it quite that long out. And we also I had thought of a million ideas and half built things along the way or whatever. But this was the one where we were like, it seems like the right idea, but we were all in on this idea. Like if it didn't work, there wasn't going to be time to like build the second idea. Like this was the idea and it's either going to sink or swim, and that's it.
Where did it start? Where did the idea come from? Like a real life need, or just some example out there in the wild, or what?
No, real life. So like, actually, Brian just asked about it kind of. So I was working at this college and they still use the mainframe and they use Linux on mainframe, whatever. And they had this help desk app that was running in a terminal window. And so you couldn't copy paste into it. It didn't accept email. Like it wasn't modern anyway. And so I'm like, wow, this is big organization that's over 1,000 people using this help desk app that's like totally insane. And so I'm like, if they're using it, like there must be other organizations that are in this insane situation. And so that was kind of impetus. And I was managing people using this app, so I had kind of support management background, and it just kind of went from there. So it was definitely a need, which I think is always a good spot for the bootstrapper. If you have a need yourself, it helps a lot.
Yeah, you know? You really understand the problem.
Yeah.
I like it. It's a little dangerous, though. It's a little dangerous.
It is dangerous.
Because we don't got the big bucks.
Right.
So ideally, you're solving problems for people with big bucks.
That's
true.
Well,
if you're always looking at your problems, you know, you get sucked into the just a different model.
Right.
Where it's a different level of value, different level of expense, all that.
For me, it worked out because I was in this bigger organization. So I knew that an organization with substantial resources had this problem, right? And then I researched it and went through all that kind of stuff and, you know, saw that there was this need, and all the help desks had existed, but they were very much like client server and like kind of old school. They weren't really internet enabled yet at that point, for the most part. So this is all like pre everything you think of now, like Zendesk or Desk.com and the big SaaS players. So,
but I think it is interesting because you basically leveraged like your unique position. Like you already had this, like you were in that world and in that you had that intelligence that like most other people can't just say like, oh, look at these big organizations. They're using mainframes and they wouldn't be aware of that stuff, you know? So,
And I think it's something people could do at their job. Like, I mean, if you have a job now, like a lot of people interact with a lot on like Twitter and stuff now, or like they're freelancers and those things are maybe a little bit harder, but if you have a regular job at a corporation, I mean, there's shit messed up all over the place in there, you know?
Yeah, like, the leave and have your ex-employer be your first customer, tried and true path.
Right. And I didn't even get that. They didn't even buy my product, but it was still the impetus for it. But yeah, I know. But it's funny because it's so different now. I'm kind of on the long-term thing. It's like, so I didn't have the long-term vision in the beginning. And that's really, like, in some ways, it stymied us, definitely. Like, I look at you guys, especially in the organization, and Brian with his, like, totally insane organizations, incredible. Like, I'm totally envious of that because I'm nowhere near that. And it's like, when you start as, like, that just you, it's just for me, and I literally only consider it as being this personal thing for me, that impacts the company like for so far into the future, because like the code's your baby, the app's your baby. Then it's hard to give some of that stuff away, and you're not even thinking in terms of processes and things like that for bringing people on board. So like, we didn't hire fast enough. We even now are not really as organized as I'd like to be in different areas. So it's kind of like in the DNA of the company right from the beginning. And so I do think like that having that idea that it could be bigger than you someday early on, and having processes for things and everything is really valuable.
I think there's this like weird balance or imbalance where it's like, whenever we any of us entrepreneurs have like a new idea that we want to maybe launch as a product, like is the idea stage, it's like you have this vision that is like this thing could be huge, or it, or like this like grand vision of like, you know, whatever it's going to grow into, and then it can iterate into this and this and this, and then so there's that, like we always have that, like you start something new and this could be the next 5-10 years,
right?
But if I look back on my last 10 years, you know, pre-Restaurant Engine, even that didn't last very long in the grand scheme of things. But the before that, like every year, I would just look at like the year as a whole. It's like, wow, I launched this, this, and this, and then those kind of fizzled out and that fizzled out. It's like these things last so such a short period of time when you look back on them. I don't know if what I'm saying actually makes sense here, but
it depends. It depends on which ones. It's also dangerous in the ones that stick, because then you're in it for 5+ years. And if you knew that going in, you may not have said, I'm going to be servicing restaurant owners for the next 5 years, and that's going to make me happy, as opposed to, you know, I think this is a good opportunity to service them. And yeah, I think it's tough to say. In hindsight, it always looks good. It sounds good in hindsight to say you have to evaluate for the long term, and you have to think, do I really want to be in this industry and talking and dealing with these people? But it's really hard to do that when you're in the moment.
Yeah, but like there was a time when I thought I was going to build up a web design agency, and that lasted like less than a year. And then there was a time when I thought I was going to do a big WordPress themes company, and that didn't last very, or, you know, that became just a side project that I forgot about for many years. And then there was Restaurant Engine, which was like, you know, this could evolve into, you know, something for the restaurant industry, and then into another niche, and then into another niche, and just grow the company that way. And then that, you know, 3-4 years later, that things have changed, you know? So it's just interesting, like how the game plan changes over the years.
Yeah. I'll tell you, to add something different to this part of the conversation is I did the same thing with a bunch of different ideas, and I stuck with some things longer and some things shorter. But everything changed the day I took other people's money. That was like, all right, not going anywhere, not focusing on anything else, not trying anything else. You know, it's just 100% forced focus. And I think in many ways that it was good and healthy for me that way, to not have an out and not say, oh, it's not growing fast enough, so I should just really move on to something else. It like took that off the table.
Do you mean Cardhook or
yeah,
or
no, before? Cardhook.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot to that, in the sense of like having something that forces your hand a little bit. I think now it's so easy to build things, right? Like, here, I can drop this framework in, and like, if I started with like the Laravel framework, which is what we use, if I started that with that today to build HubSpot version 1, I would have been done in like 2 weeks. Instead, it took me 6 months of like continuous, like 14-hour days to build where I could be in 2 weeks now, because so much is done for you. And that is great, but it also can be a negative, because it's like, well, I'll do this thing, okay? And then I'm kind of bored with that. I'll do this other thing. And you know you don't have that like startup cost. Like there's not...
Yeah, but you never get to the epiphany.
Right. Like if we had the forced commitment, it wasn't a technical one. It was partially technical because it took so long, and it was also financial. It was like we didn't have investors, but we were our investors, right? And we were like, this is the money we got to try this, and this is the 6 months I'm gonna give it or whatever, and see how it goes. But so there is something to that. Yeah, I don't know. It's kind of weird for me, because I didn't have like I had a bunch of ideas that I half started. But they were just like things I coded like at night, and I never launched any of the stuff. So the first thing I ever really tried and launched was HelpSpot. And that's just been with me the whole time. So, you know, we did have another product, Snappy, that I would call it a failure, even though it's like still around and everything. But even that is like what's 8 years into the business or 7 years into the business. So it's kind of a little bit different than your first thing. But
was Snappy sold?
Yeah, I still own a little piece of it, but yeah, it's
nice
with other people now. But we lost a lot of money on it. So it's like it's sold, but not in a good way. Like,
yeah.
You know,
yeah,
it's got a new home and people who are going to take care of it, and it's not going to distract us from what we have to do with HelpSpot, but it's not, it was definitely a money loser in terms of the amount we spent on building it and everything.
But it's interesting, you know, like Jordan, you said that taking investors helped you stay committed and focused to making that work. I mean, I think it's similar to Ian's story early on. I mean, quitting your job is like,
right,
kind of the same kind of pressure. You know, it's like you can't afford to just jump around, you know, in that first year. I mean, I sometimes wish that I had that sort of pressure in looking back in my history, like, because what I did was what I think a lot of freelancers and consultants do, which is like just gradually, slowly phase down the consulting work as the product phases up. And I mean, that was like a two to three year transition of like, after the first year, I thought I was like completely done with consulting, and then things slowed down, and then I had to take on more consulting, and then I had to phase it out again. And it was like, it's just a really draining, maybe too long of a process, where sometimes I wish that I had kind of a steady part-time job that I could just go to for X hours a week for a company that I don't own, and I could just get a paycheck for a while I built something up, and then either decide to like quit and commit full time. You know, I wish I would have had something more like that.
Yeah, now you have it in the form of clients and employees.
Right, I was going to say that's your like commitment. Yeah, now, you're right? In. You're in. Like
you can't just be like, I'm just going to drop it. Like that causes this huge outward cataclysm.
That's true. With Audience Ops now, and I've had teammates before, like in Restaurant Engine, but it was a much smaller team on Restaurant Engine, and they were all still completely contractors. And in Audience Ops, we have a couple of full-time employees. Ian, I know you have a team of some full-timers, and we still have a mix of contractors and full-time, but the team is so large now. Like I just ran payroll this morning, and it's like, that is a lot of scary pressure.
Right?
Yeah.
How many people are you working with, Ian?
We have right now, so it's me and Jamie, and then four full-time people.
Wow.
And we don't really use a lot of contractors. I mean, we contract out to like agencies a little bit for like design occasionally and stuff, but I've always had like extremely horrible luck with contractors. But I don't know. I think it could be like I don't have the procedures and things part, right? Like, I don't know. I don't know if it's that. I don't know if it's me or if it's them. I mean, a lot of people just like I've hired and they literally haven't even shown up to do anything. Yeah. So I don't know.
No, it's all over the map. I mean, yeah, it's very, very hit and miss.
So I've always been like, I'm just hiring full time. I don't care. Like it's more money. It's more, there's a lot of things that are, we spend a lot of money on just like accounting and dealing with different states and all this stuff.
No, but
at the same time, it's like, I don't care because I can't deal with the contractors. Like it's too in and out. So
what do they do? Are they all on the tech side?
No, it's two developers and one person in sales and one in support.
This is kind of a tangent into like hiring, I guess, but I think the difference, maybe, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, Ian, but the difference I think between hiring only full-time versus hiring contractors and then making some of them full-time, the way that I see it is if you're only hiring full-time employees, you must spend a pretty heavy amount of time vetting them and doing interviews, probably multiple interviews before they come on board, right? Like for me, maybe it's just a weakness on my part, but I hate that process.
Right.
I just can't stand the recruiting and hiring and application process. So I just try to get through that as fast as I possibly can. And I do spend enough time to really vet like who's coming on board and who do I put on a short list. But the idea is like, I'm only hiring them as a freelance contractor to start. And it's like sink or swim from there, you know, and then, you know, maybe a couple months down the road, they ramp up to the point where they're full time and they're already like they're proven.
So, I mean, I think for me, there's like a couple parts to that. One is I've hired a lot of people, a number of people who worked at Userscape are people I approached. And so I think that like I actually have this article like half written. I plan to get out this summer about like keeping a list of people. Like as I come across people, I note them and say, this person's really good. And when I'm ready for that, like I'm going to go to them first. And so that's part of being out. Like we're involved in Laravel, so we know a lot of developers. And, you know, so I've been able to meet people and have some people I know who are talented. But then even when we hire, I think it's a little bit also the world's kind of changed in the past 10 years. Because like 10 years ago, I was very much, and I still, I guess, kind of am, but I think it has changed that like all the good people have jobs. Like no, there's not a lot of people who are really good who don't have a job. And so like the freelancers in like 2005, it's like, I don't know if those are like the top people that I want to employ, you know? And I think now that there's so much more opportunity for people to be freelancers and make a living just doing that, especially on like the tech end and some of these other areas, or and even in like the writing, because now, I mean, 10 years ago, you couldn't do that because there's no like market, but now there's all these markets and all that kind of stuff. So I think that it's different now where that's a more viable approach because you can hire 3 or 4 people and they're contractors and a couple of them are going to be really good. And then you can go that next step. With, I mean, and business-wise, it totally makes a lot of sense. Like it's more affordable. You could test drive and just see if, you know, they culturally fit and then obviously the work if it's there. And
but all still, stuff. Still, it like never ceases to amaze me how unpredictable it is. I mean, I've been wrong almost every single time where it comes down to like top 3 candidates for a position.
Right.
And in my mind, there's one that I'm kind of leaning towards, like they're probably going to be the rock star out of this group.
Yeah.
And it's never that person. Like that's the person who doesn't show up. And it's the other person who's like the total rock star. It's just like, you can't predict it until they're actually in the business, you know?
So have you, do you let them go often when they're not working out, or is it kind of work itself out, or do you end up like firing a lot of them, or how does that go?
Unfortunately, I've had to let go about 3 freelancers after probably within the first month of them working in audience ops.
Okay. At least you've been able to do it quickly.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, I'd say 1 to 2 months because one time there was just kind of a quality of work issue, but the other 2 times it was just like you're not meeting deadlines. And we don't have a crazy deadline schedule. Like we give them probably more time than what most clients give. But, you know, we do have a production process and like, you know, we just can't, first time you're late, then it's like, okay, just letting you know, this is really important that you've got to hit deadlines. And the second time it's like, all right, you know, this, you haven't fixed it. Yeah. You know, so those things happen.
So I have a question for you actually, for Brian. I think I understand where Jordan would be on this, but Jordan definitely, obviously you can answer with your end of it too, if I may interview you guys back. But so I think this fits in good with the long term. Because one of the questions I have about audience ops, so audience ops, it's like blown up, it's huge, it's amazing story. But I always wonder where like the plugins and like, I think on the last episode you were talking about like a consulting service. And every time I'm like yelling at the podcast, I'm like, don't do that, Brian. Just get rid of all that crap and just do audience ops. But so I'm like curious on like the strategy, like 5 years from now, is it really like a software business that sells plugins? Or is it just, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, where is that going?
So that's a good question. So the way that I think about the long-term vision of what audience should be when it's, I don't know, quote unquote complete, would be it's not just the done-for-you service. It's the done-for-you service is probably like 1/3 of it. The next thing that I plan to roll out this year is a training product. A really like exhaustive training product that founders can buy and then implement into their business. Like basically training you on how to build your own in-house content marketing team, like giving you all the systems and processes that we use, how to hire writers, how to get them into an editorial calendar and assistants and all that. So that's the next piece is to have like an educational arm of audience ops selling like educational products. And then the third piece would be software, which, you know, the plugins that we do we're kind of like dabbling in that kind of, and we use the plugins like for our clients, but then other customers just buy them as standalone.
It's like an offshoot of the main business or whatever.
Yeah. Like we had to build them in order to implement the stuff that we wanted to do for our clients. And we're continuing to build those out. I think that long term, the plugins, I think maybe in the next year, two years or so, we'll maybe convert those over to some sort of SaaS or just build some kind of new SaaS. But the way that I see the SaaS evolving is it's starting with the training product. Like that's the next product that we're going to build. And then out of the training product, we're going to build tools to help you implement the stuff that we're teaching in the training product. You know, if you think about like what Brendan Dunn built with, I know he doesn't own PlanScope anymore, but if you think about it, all of his products really fit well together. So he's got, for a while there, he was teaching, I mean, he still does this. He teaches consultants on how to build an agency, a highly efficient agency. And then he had PlanScope, which was a SaaS like specifically designed to run your agency in the way, in like the method that Brennan teaches.
Yeah.
You know, so that's that, like right now, that's kind of the concept of what audience ops will be. It'll be like, you know, essentially the way that I would explain it is we are a content marketing company and we're aimed at helping founders do content marketing in a effective way. And we do that by either doing it completely for you. That's like the highest price option.
Right.
We can teach you how to do it yourself. That would be kind of like the middle option. And we sell software tools to help you do it. Like that's the end game basically.
Kind of.
Like to the question of like, I've had plenty of other people ask me the same question about like, why, like forget all that stuff. Why, like audience ops, the service is working. It's profitable. Right. It is scaling up. Like, why don't you just keep doing that? I was actually just on the Zero to Scale podcast this week with Justin and Greg talking about, and we kind of debated back and forth, like, is it actually scalable?
Right. What is scalable? Right.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
And it really is a valid question. I think I think the answer is yes, it is scalable and we are scaling up. We have a team of 20 plus people. We've got, you know, more than that in terms of clients, and it has remained profitable and same level of profitability as we go up. But obviously the more clients we bring on, the larger the team grows, and it's really just a matter of preference. Like I think Justin was asking the question like, okay, so what does this business look like when it's a $5 million business?
Right.
And, you know, that's going to look like a team of hundreds probably.
Right.
and like, it's a question of like, do I want to scale to that point? And probably not. So that's why I want to make the long-term game be, okay, let's launch these more scalable, products. But
do you think
the definition of scalable, that's,
well,
I guess I mean more
profitable products.
Right. So it sounded to me like Justin was looking at it from a software point of view and saying scalable is increasing efficiency, right? As you grow, you can service more and therefore make more. There's not a direct relationship between what you need in terms of resources inside the company, how much revenue you can make. Where in a software company, 10 people can make $1 million a month and 20 people can make $20 million a month. So it's really, really efficient. I think that's what he kept referring to as scale, whereas the word scale means nothing without context. It's like, how do you grow a solid, profitable business is really the only question we're asking.
The way that I think about it, maybe, I don't know if others would agree or not, but the way I think that it's the ability or not to actually grow the business, like scale it up. Like
What does that mean?
Well, just like
100 grand a month.
Because what I was doing, but what I was doing a few years ago as a solo freelance web designer, like that was not scalable.
Right.
Because I would run out of hours in the day.
Ability to achieve fuck you money.
No, I mean that like I could not unless I started hiring people. But many freelancers don't take that step. You're just selling your hours in the day, and there's a limit to that. And at some point, like, you can't scale up even if you want to. So like that's how I think of scale.
Well, I was wondering, so what I was thinking about with audience ops, if I can armchair quarterback your business for a moment, if I can take over your podcast here, is like, instead of those software products underneath or like the training stuff as like the like tier up to like audience ops as it currently is like the top tier. I was kind of thinking audience ops, I envisioned it when I think about audience ops as like what you do now is the bottom tier. And like, you're going to go up from that. You're going to have a thing that like when you deal with Merck and Merck comes to you and says, write content for us. Like that's $1 million a year for you to have specialists in pharmaceuticals who write content for Merck. And then you have something in between for, you know, it's like right now it's more like smaller SaaS companies and whatever. I don't know all your customers, but it's that level. It's like a couple thousand bucks a month. That's like a no-brainer. Great. And then like it scales up to like more
so
niche, bigger organizations that
you so you're saying like scale it up to like higher priced contracts for essentially the same. Well, it might be different work for like an enterprise kind of.
Right. Like they're going to want different things from you. Like they're going to need specialists probably or whatever. But if you charge them $1 million a year, great. You're going to go find four writers who know all kinds of stuff about pharmaceuticals and you're going to write them articles about drugs or whatever, and like that's going to be like the high end,
but I
clientele.
That sounds like just a price issue. It's the same service,
Right. It's a very similar service, probably with more, probably like a dedicated project. I mean, that they got the upper tier, right? There's more people involved, but it's also much bigger price tags.
I think it's a valid point, but I think the reason why I'm not as attracted to that plan is I think two reasons. Number one, it sounds more like an agency, and I do differentiate between like having an agency and a productized service.
Sure.
How?
An agency basically does all this different custom work for different requirements, which is harder to scale, harder to streamline when you're doing all this custom variations. What we do now is very standardized across all of our clients. But that's
like
number one.
An agency that does a productized service. I mean, whatever the word agency.
Yeah, I mean, it's semantics, but I just think that like a digital agency, I used to work at some web design agencies where it's like 20 different clients want 20 different things and the profitability goes down the toilet because you're just adding all these extra hours and just managing these variables. And then you got to hire these like specialists just to serve like one or two clients. And like, that's not the most efficient thing, but really I think the bigger reason is from a marketing perspective, I'd rather continue to just hammer on, like really just grow this one audience, which are, you know, B2B software companies, SaaS founders, small to medium, you know, growing businesses, rather than have a fragmented audience to sell to. You know, if we have this one core audience of software business owners, and we can sell them a whole product line and just keep growing that one audience. I see that as more of an efficient way to grow.
I mean, you can still do the same thing even within that audience, right? Like, I mean, just to take a way out there example, like Salesforce could be a client, right? And you could be doing a whole bunch of content for Salesforce, which would still be B2B SaaS and all that, but it would obviously be on a whole different scale. I'm sure, especially in B2B SaaS, you will hit people who want to do it themselves or whatever, obviously. But I don't know. I think there's going to be a lot of people. I could see a lot of people who don't want to do it themselves too. You know, like I think that
there definitely are.
That's right.
There are clients, you know?
Even in big companies. Like a lot of times, the big companies they don't want to hire a whole team of people. Like they want to just spend $500,000 and they know they should be doing this thing, and it's much easier to spend $500,000 than to hire like three people and learn how to do it and all that stuff.
Well,
and
that's
even
where,
staying very niche-y, like you don't do whatever, you're not building their website, you're not doing anything. You're just writing content, but it's for them and it's at a bigger scale maybe or higher cost.
Well, I think, and not to make this whole episode about me and audience ops, sure. but it's
your podcast.
Well, the thing with the training product is kind of aimed at two things. You know, one if your business is like a highly niche, specialized industry where it's just so technical or so specialized that it just doesn't make sense for our team to write for that.
Where you're not ready for it yet.
Well, I mean,
like you don't want to go that far with it yet.
Yeah, I mean, we have certain processes now to dig into to the more people who are more on that niche side of things, and kind of bring them more into the process of like researching topics and things like that. But you know, the idea with the training is like if it just makes more sense for your business to do it in house and have someone embedded in your team doing content, then here's the process to do it effectively and the strategy, the automation workflows, the back end, you know, funnels and all that. You know, so I think it's a combination of like if your company has grown to a point where it doesn't make sense to outsource it, but you want to do it in-house, or your company is like bootstrapping and you can't necessarily afford outsourcing, you know, and the done for you, the price will increase once we have these other products. So, you know, that would make sense.
I think the reason that strategy or that whole vision works is because you're taking one problem and you are... The whole company is aimed at solving that problem.
That's
and so
it.
There are different ways to solve it. Mm. And if you have different entry points for people to use your methodology and your point of view on how to solve the problem, it's just, I think it's great to start off with the product or service part.
Yeah. And I've written about that a lot is right. Like that's the way to self-fund and launch the company, but not just from the funding point of view. Like obviously with productized service, you can grow revenue pretty quickly, but you can also establish yourself, like plant your flag, like we are a content marketing company, or we are a lead generation company, or we, you know, like And then you start to grow an audience around that and start to gain credibility around that. And then you're, and then a year, 2 years later, when you're ready to launch a training product or a SaaS, you've got this list, you've got this credibility in this space. Like, it's much easier to
an experience in the market.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the big thing. You don't know every detail of what the market wants until you really start interacting.
Don't you think it's funny that every single freelancer consultant is dying to have their own SaaS? Like, they
I know,
all
but
want
they're,
their own SaaS.
They're wrong. They're totally
I know. Wrong. I tell them all they're wrong all the time. And like, I don't know. I just feel like they're all like, we're making so much money. It's even like Brian. We're making so much money. We're super successful. But we have to have a SaaS. And I'm like, why do you have to have a SaaS? You don't have to have a SaaS. Like, you're making
hot.
A lot of money. Be happy. It's not bad. It's not necessarily better on this side. I can tell you there's a lot of times where like it's like July 4th and somebody's thing starts freaking out and like they're calling you and people are flipping out on you and you want to be like at a barbecue and instead you're working on a server or whatever.
And
like,
the other thing that I see a lot, even within the productized service world, is there's everybody wants recurring revenue. And we all know how great recurring revenue it is in theory and it's ongoing revenue. I think it downplays some of the value of having a one-time purchase or selling a one-time purchase. I mean, number one, it's so much easier to sell a one-time purchase than a recurring, even if the recurring is only $50 a month.
Definitely.
It's easier
hard to find a few hundred
it's
people.
It's actually easier to sell a $500 one-time thing than a $50 a month thing.
Yeah. It's like a human psychology thing going on there.
Yeah. Yeah. And like if you sell a one-time purchase, you get all the lifetime value up front.
Right.
Whereas a SaaS, like every SaaS deals with churn. Every sort of recurring revenue business deals with some sort of churn.
That's why I feel like they missed that idea that like there's such a line. The SaaS creates such alignment between the customer and the business that it's much harder because you don't have to just convince them one time. Every month you're convincing them that stay with you, stay with you, stay with you, stay with you. So like there's a tremendous support, burden there and ongoing like working.
The competition is ridiculous.
I mean, there's also ridiculous competition.
There are amazing, amazing companies. And when you have someone come into your space and raise $8 million, like they're going to beat you on a lot of things. Yeah. They're going to have better stuff. You know, like out of the list of 10 things, you're not going to be able to win on all 10 of them. You're going to have to deal with it. And a lot of times, like I think about Rare.io, this amazing email software, they sell it for like $29 a month. Like, what are you doing? What are you guys doing? You know, and it blows other software out of the water. And it's like, what are you trying to do? You're trying to get 100,000 customers? Like, that's not going to work. But they're funded, so they don't have to worry about profitability for 3 years. Right. And you got to deal with that. You got to deal with people saying, so it sounds like you do a lot of what Rare.io does, but their template builder is better. And they have like 4 people on support. And you're 3 times as expensive. It's like, yeah, I know. I know all of that.
Well, I definitely think bootstrappers, especially like there is this whole thing now where you have to really think so carefully about your niche and like what your unique proposition is because you can't really go head to head with them, you know, with the big funded players. It's really hard. Like they're going to outspend you everywhere. They're going to have more features. The features are going to be better features. Like they're going to be more polished. So I think you have to like pick really carefully.
Yeah, you've got to position yourself, or you've got to find ways to position yourself differently. I mean, you look at like Drip and ConvertKit up against the MailChimps and the Infusionsoft, and you know.
And even then, they position themselves well because MailChimp doesn't really do what those guys do. You know what I mean? Like now they could. And if they do, I think that's going to be bad for them. Although I think maybe they're both big enough now that like they're not like, going to go out of business if that happens. But like find that niche. Like MailChimp doesn't think it was worth going into like that level of like automation or to make it so simple like ConvertKit does or whatever. Like there's those
I do think there's something goals. Like going looking inward to seeing like what am I personally most like best positioned to do. And I think looking at both of your stories, you know, Ian, like you were talking about earlier, you worked in an enterprise setting where they needed a help desk solution. You know, Jordan, you built and launched and sold an e-commerce business and now you do a product for e-commerce companies. You know, that was something that I think I was probably missing in Restaurant Engine. It was like, I had no personal connection to the restaurant industry.
Yeah, it's hard.
No advantage.
That's what led me to kind of just finally come to the decision. Like, this is not the long-term play for me. Audience Ops is, or at least that's how I think of it right now, because it's for this audience that I can actually connect with, like people that I talk to at MicroConf and other, you know, software business owners. This one is much more about thinking long term. Like I could easily spend 5+ years on this.
Yeah, and like being just aware of like your surroundings is so important, and it's so hard when you're like deep in it, you know. But like for us, one of the things that's happened is like we launched HelpSpot, and our thing was kind of like your help desk in your browser, even though it was only on premise, so you had to download it and install it, but you didn't have like a special client or whatever. Like just use your browser. Great. Okay, so that was new. Everybody liked that. Great. You know, all big name companies are using us, all that cool stuff. Then like, you know, the big SaaS players come in like 2008 and 2009 and all that. And now obviously that's not new. Like being in your browser, like that's just like table stakes. Everybody gets that, right? Like, but now an interesting thing is there's no new help desk competitors that allow you to be on premise. So now like we've got that niche, like in a sense, because we still let you download it, install it. And for a lot of companies, that's an important thing. Like they have regulations, or they just have a big IT department and they want to justify it, right? And so
that's interesting.
So they don't want to use Zendesk or whatever. And or they can't. They actually can't use it. And so now we have that little niche that we've been working more on playing up, where that used to be a thing we had to overcome. Like, yeah, you have to install it. I know you don't want to, but it's better in these ways. That's great. Now that's like a plus for a lot of people. Like, hey, you can install it yourself on your own servers and manage it and back it up. And like, isn't that awesome? And we have a SaaS version now, and we have a lot of customers who use that. But you know, there's still a fair chunk that, you know, more than half who are on premise. So, and that's an area where nobody's going to build. Zendesk isn't going to build on premise Zendesk. Like, yeah. That's not going to happen.
And
so,
again, like the SaaS companies don't want to build like a non SaaS version of their
right. You know. So, can you do stuff as the little guy that somebody else just doesn't want to do because it sucks and it's crappy, and like you have to fix people's IIS and you have to fix their Exchange connection and blah, like all this horrible support stuff we have to do that we wouldn't do if we were SaaS. But on the flip side, like that's the value. Like nobody else will even do that at all for them. So, you know, it's interesting.
So Jordan, where are you at on this with Carthook? Because I know that we've touched on it a little bit, but I'm kind of unclear. Like what are you thinking in terms of like the long game? Because so you started with cart abandonment. And now you recently launched the Shopify checkout product. Where are things going from here?
Yeah, I don't mind talking about it now. Things are more out in the open finally. Freaking right. Stealth is the worst thing ever. So there's two things to this. I don't think about the big picture long term as just Carthook. I think about like where does Carthook fit into what I'm actually trying to do. But to start off with the long-term vision of Carthook, I think it's a lot like Ian says. You're in a market, and then you just pay attention and you follow your gut on where you should go. So a few months ago, when we were faced with that decision of should we stick with cart abandonment or expand to a new product, I just kind of saw the writing on the wall where cart abandonment is it's a great place to be because it makes people money in a quantifiable way. So they keep paying you because they're happy because you're making the money. So it's a good product. The nature of it is good. At the same time, so much competition has come in and everyone's undercutting each other on price. And so that helped make the decision of, hey, I see this other opportunity and this other product on in terms of the checkout. So thinking down the road, 1, 2, 3 years, it made sense to get into another product. Now we're in another product. The funny thing is that we're actually building the product we're building now isn't just the checkout. It's going to turn into a funnel builder, and Shopify will be one of our integrations. It's not going to be a Shopify product. It's just Shopify is the right place to start. So we have the checkout page replacement, and then along with that, we're going to have a landing page builder. And so people will be able to create a landing page, checkout page, upsell and downsell pages, and then a thank you page. So it'll be a standalone platform for e-commerce. It's a funnel, like ClickFunnels for e-commerce, basically. And then it'll connect with platforms like Shopify. So it'll put the order data into those platforms so people can still work in those platforms and kind of treat the orders like any other order. And we see that as lowering the barrier. Instead of saying, you're currently selling on BigCommerce, come off of BigCommerce onto our platform, that's a big ask. We want to kind of lure them in by saying, BigCommerce, Shopify limits you in the marketing strategy that you want to implement, and our platform is marketing first. So all this funnel strategy, all these landing pages, where you want to send your paid traffic, that's what we want to do. And then the longer term vision is, well, I make all my money on Carthook's platform and I'm just using BigCommerce as the back end. So once Carthook starts to build in these cart features like shipping, inventory, all these other things, people will be able to start coming onto us as a standalone platform itself.
Mm.
Right. So that's kind of where things are headed.
Nice. I hadn't thought of it that way, where that's the long-term play to actually build it into some sort of standalone e-commerce platform. And obviously that's like too huge of a thing to do from day one. And maybe now it's still a little bit too premature for that. But I like what you're doing, where you're kind of evolving, like the initial product that was kind of like a plugin. And those are turning more into like features of a larger product. And then that larger product is eventually going to be like by the time you have all these features in place, Carthook will have been around long enough that you've built up a strong enough customer base and audience and footprint in this industry that launching or announcing that you're now a standalone platform is not as huge of a hurdle as it would be from day one.
Yeah. And we don't even need to announce that we're a standalone platform. It just kind of sneaks its way into, well, you know, why should I keep using this when this is already doing the job? But that's going to take time. So I could go down to San Francisco and start begging for $3 million. Or we could do this incremental thing where it's okay. Cart abandonment brings in revenue. Good. That covers a lot of the expenses. Now the checkout product will, you know, hopefully get us past profitability. And then the next thing and the next thing. And so we just have this stable.
I feel like this is, I think, the smarter way to go about it. You know, people love to talk about like the VC versus bootstrapping or fund strapping, you know. And it's not just black and white, where like if you take millions of dollars in VC, you can get to the same result but faster. Like no, not necessarily. I think that route, just talking about what we're just talking about here, it skips the process of building up a footprint and an audience and a customer base, and like no matter what, that's going to take time. So if you know going in, like you have to spend X number of years in order to reach that level of notoriety. Like VC money doesn't guarantee that you'll get there that fast.
No, but it does accelerate things. Like we could really use 4 developers right now. Instead, we have 1 who's...
But there is something that hunger does to you, though. Like it does help guide you potentially.
The focus is the end result. The end result isn't how to get to 100 grand a month in your business. Right. The end result is how does all that money end up in my bank account? The reason to go or not go down to Silicon Valley and ask for VC money isn't about will you get to the same place in terms of the business, because there's no question if I had $1 million in the bank account right now in the business and we'd hire, we would go a lot faster and the revenue would grow a lot faster.
Well, in terms of the product, yes, but the marketing wouldn't scale at the same rate.
I don't care about the marketing. I care about my bank account. And if you take on $2 million at a valuation of whatever, 6 or 8 million, you can't make a lot of money unless you sell the company for $30 or $40 million. And in not going that route, if somebody comes along and offers you $10 million for the company, a whole bunch of that's going to end up in my bank account. So $5 million after tax in my bank account, if that's the actual goal, going down to Silicon Valley and asking for $2 million, that actually pushes the goal way off. It makes it much harder to achieve because you need to sell for $30, $40, $50 million in order to make the return. So I only see it as a game.
Maybe I'm just looking at it like more of a simplistic, too simplistic of a view on this, but the VC route, I feel like adds much higher risk of the whole thing flopping and going down to zero than the slow multi-year bootstrapping or fund strapping approach, because you're putting that time in, you're just naturally going to stick around, which means sticking around in the minds of customers in this market. Whereas like 90%+ of VC backed companies, nobody has ever heard of, and they go in and out within 6 months. You know,
because you're going to make decisions based on revenue versus making decisions based on getting to $50 million valuation.
And you can buy engineers and buy a product, like buy the building of a product very quickly with a VC backed company. But you can't just you could spend millions on ads, but that's not just going to instantly successfully grow your audience. You know.
Yeah, but there's no we can't pretend that it doesn't help a lot. I think what it does, it doesn't
retard, but it doesn't
retard the decision making process in many ways.
It doesn't get people talking about you like authentically.
But I also it could be tricky, where you've already kind of pivoted successfully here a little bit, and you're not totally off of CarHook, it doesn't sound like, right? But you're kind of doing both. Like, that would be harder if you had a bunch of money, probably, in some ways. Do you know what I mean? Like, you would have been really doubled down on CarHook, and you might not have even been able to take that opportunity. Yep. And you'd have to justify it to people too, right? Like, you'd have to be like, I'm making this huge change in our business.
Yeah.
I think it's the right change.
We have investors. It's not VC.
I know you have a little bit of angel, like your friends and family kind of thing.
Even that, there was a hurdle to explain. Right. are you telling me you're building a new product now? So that was a hurdle.
But even your this new vision, I mean, I think I really like the idea of just like the landing page part. I mean, landing page for e-commerce, that seems like a great idea. Like, forget even the whole being the whole store. Like, I think there's like, I mean, it's like Lead Pages or any of these guys. I know they do more now, but I mean, they were multi-million dollar businesses when they were just, here's a landing page.
Yeah, landing pages are thought of in the context of marketing,
right?
And picking up email addresses. And everyone right now is spending money on Facebook and Google AdWords in their e-commerce business to sell physical products. And they're sending them into the product page inside the site.
Right.
And that's like sending it to your features page on your SaaS business. Like, you don't want to do that. You want to send it to a dedicated landing page where there's a decision or no decision.
So it's I love that idea. I mean, I think that right there is like the only thing I'd be thinking about. And like the rest of it, if it happens, whatever, who cares? Like,
getting there with one developer,
it's true,
means you can say, you know what? We're not going to put anything into the market for 3 months. Or we can say, let's get the checkout page and then let's add upsells after it.
Yeah.
Right. So right now we have the checkout page, and then we're adding upsells after it. And then we're going to come out and say, wait a minute, totally. Now it's like for real. Now it's like.
I think the sequence of what you're doing makes a lot of sense, because it was CartHook, cart abandonment. It's all about the shopping cart. Now it's the checkout page, which is still very interconnected with the checkout experience. So like you're going
optimization,
essentially where the transaction is. You know, the most critical part. So
selling off like the CartHook part or something like that. I know it's hard to sell like a when it's not.
It's crossed our minds, but right now it's the savior.
Right.
Right now it brings in money and it keeps growing, and so that kind of allows everything else to happen. Yeah. And the truth is, that's a differentiator now, because we include our cart abandonment software in our checkout page. Mm-hmm. So now you can get rid of your other one that you pay $50 or $100 a month for, because you get it put in. And I just did a webinar last week, and one of the bonuses was a full year of card abandonment for free. Mm. And people pay us, you know, $100 to $1,500 a month for that. And so that helped make the sale for the other. So it's all kind of all together.
Interesting.
But here's the thing that so what we just talked about is the long term for the company. But the long term for personally, and I think this is maybe why I argued so much about the VC and the advantages of money, is because my hope, my intention is that CartHook either kicks off enough money or gets acquired for enough money so that I can come in and compete with companies like CartHook and HelpSpot and blow them out of the water with money. But do the same thing that they're doing and beat them because of resources, because I think all of us right now we're vulnerable. We're all vulnerable. We're all making somewhere between 10, 50 grand a month, somewhere in there, which is just, that's not enough to compete when you're paying salaries and all that. So a company that identifies something like CartHook and says, I'm going to deploy even something like $500,000, hire a few people, and blow them out of the water in 6 months, I want to be able to do that with the money that Carthook kicks off or creates.
The way I think about it is, I think you probably spend more time thinking about this than I do. The long, long, long game, right? I just think about it in chapters of the career or of life or whatever. Like right now, we're all like entrepreneurs focused on mainly one business at a time. The next chapter, years down the line, after you've had some successful things under your belt, things have sold, now you have money in the bank, then it becomes like the next chapter is like empire, where you're just like allocating, you've got all these different businesses that, or maybe you go into investing, but.
Okay, so here's a funny analogy though. What we're talking about right now is being in the bootstrap SaaS market and keeping our eyes open, right, Ian? And looking yep. around at what's happening and where the opportunity is. And the opportunity that I see, and this is incredibly cynical and I feel like a dick when I think about it and I say it, but whatever, it's the truth. The opportunity right now is a lot of these bootstrap SaaS businesses are, the people running them are so talented and so awesome, but there's the gap between where they are and the VC world that ignores them because, you know, it's not going to be a $100 million business. There's a gap in between those two, and that's where the opportunity is. The opportunity is to say, HelpSpot is a bad example because it's been around for a while, but we see these new businesses that come out, and within 6 months, they get to like 10K in MRR, and it's one founder, and that guy's freaking awesome. But if you came into the same market with 500 grand in the tank, that person has now identified that there's a market there, and there's a need, and there's a starting point. And to effectively copy what they're doing and then innovate and then push money into that, I see that that's the opportunity. It's all these pioneers in bootstrap SaaS playing in markets that the VCs ignore, but there's still a lot of money. But the fact that, you know, that we don't have money behind us to push, in the grand scheme of things, 500 grand in the business world is not much. To an individual, it's a lot.
But do you think I wonder if that's a real opportunity in the sense of like, because if it's a really big opportunity and you have 500,000 to put in, then there's somebody with 2 million to put in. Do you know what I mean? Like there's somebody else with more money. There's always going to be somebody else with more money. So I wonder if that's like,
and the money's ignoring it because people don't look at a lot of the businesses that people like us are running and they don't see them being able to get. You can't put in $2 million into a business unless you think it can sell for at least $20
million. Right. But so that I wonder if some of these things are like niche. So like let's say like you're not going to put $1 million into an on-premise help desk app, right? That would be a hard thing to do. I mean, it's possible and somebody could try, but yeah. I think it's unlikely that somebody would do that. Or like building up 30 people to write content. Like some of these things are just hard and not sexy and not the upside is not $1 billion business. And so I do think that gets tricky when you're investing to like be to make money in that in between zone is actually really hard, which is part of the reason why I think nobody's there.
That does like, exist.
It's hard because like if I only put 500,000, it's probably not enough. Once I start to get more than that, now I need to get 30, 50 million out because otherwise like we're going to lose money as investors.
And, you know, looking at that middle zone of like these successful SaaS, quote unquote, successful SaaS companies, right? I think all of them originated, like we've been talking about, from some sort of like leveraging a personal insight from a previous experience.
Like kind of unique advantage.
I mean, I'm doing audience hops now. It's content marketing because in my previous company, we used almost exclusively content marketing to grow that. And that's what led into the idea and the ability for me to even think about this to do for this company. Restaurant Engine, I was using WordPress pretty heavily before that for client stuff. And that's what led into doing that as a business. And like, you know, you with e-commerce experience. So like, And I think obviously there's a market for angel investors and VCs to just invest in these small businesses. But I don't know about the idea of just, I don't know if this is where you're going with it, but like CEO-ing 10 different businesses.
I think incubating would be closer.
Well, you know, it's an interesting idea that I know two people who I know who are doing this. Which kind of gets at what you're talking about, Jordan, which is rather than, all right, you identify this company that's at 10,000 MRR and building a competing company, right? What they're doing is they're just buying that company because like, the SaaS founders had enough.
Is that JD?
Yeah, JD. I know another guy does it too. So just buy a bunch of these little companies. Like, you know, well, you're in it at 3 years and you're at $10,000 a month. You're like, I'm done with this. Like, it's never going anywhere. Like, and if you have the bankroll, right, then you could just buy it and be like, hey, I'm earning the, essentially interest on this investment. And I just keep it running. Like, I think that's what I would do if I had $5 million. I'd be like, I'm just buying a bunch of these little SaaSes.
I'm not
just let them roll. Person. Like, let them keep going. You well, know, that's a great idea.
It's the same concept. JD is my hero. JD, right? I listened to an interview. We're talking about JD Graffam, who, I don't know, he's somewhere out in the South. And he was running, he's still running Tennessee, an agency, I believe. Mm-hmm. And he's been acquiring small SaaS companies. That what's his criteria? Don't require heavy upkeep, and the founder is leaving for good reasons.
Yeah.
Right? And he's I don't know how many, he's got a bunch now. He most recently bought GetFlow from MetaLab.
And he was at BaconBiz, and people are freaking out on him. And I was like defending him because I was like, listen, this is, I know everybody wants to like have the vision and like
freaking out on him, what? Like negatively?
That, yeah, kind of negatively. But I was like, you know, I think it's awesome. I don't know. It's on a panel. I was like, I was defending him. I'm like, I don't know. I think they view it as like taking advantage of the founder. But I know for me, like, I mean, heck, there's been times along the way here I've been like, where's somebody with a checkbook? Like, get me the hell out of here. Like, this is stressful. So, I mean, I think that as long as it's a fair, you know, I think he's paying a fair amount and, you know.
I don't know his backstory, but, and, you know, this is running long. Maybe we'll wrap it up right after this, but
we're in the freaking good stuff now, Brian.
you know, maybe,
I told you we'd get to an hour. You
said that's right. So, you know, thinking about like that next chapter, the long game. I would think that, you know, like this guy, like why not just buy up these businesses? Like, do we want to be the entrepreneur again? Like, do we want to start something from the ground up again and again and again? Or does it just get, I think having that money makes it easier to just invest or buy out and put people in place to do it for you.
Look, some people want to be the founder because that's their favorite thing in the world. But I think that the test is, somebody came along right now and wrote you a check for $5 million to walk away from your business. Would you start the next business the same way you started this one? I'm going to say unlikely.
I always wonder though, if that would be bad. You know what I mean? It's like, if you have the money, I mean, a lot of founders fail in their second business. And I think there's like a reason for that, you know, because like you don't have that, I'm not going to work 14-hour days anymore, you know, and I'm not going to, and I don't need to. But then, yeah. You know what I mean?
They don't have that hunger.
Yeah, you don't have the hunger. I don't know. And I do think the investing, I mean, I've done like 3 small angel investments, okay? And 2 of them, I've already lost all my money. And the other one is Buffer, which is okay. But it's not like, and I wasn't in the first round, so I'm not like going to be filthy rich or anything. Yeah. But even that, I mean, it's profitable, but it's not like a guaranteed thing. So I think it is tricky. Like once you just even doing that, because I had that same idea. I was like, all right, when I'm out of this someday, I'll like be an investor. And I'm like, boy, this is pretty hard. Like picking winners is tricky. So well, I don't know.
The passive version of angel investing guarantees low likelihood of success. It's just in its nature. What JD is doing is removing a lot of that risk. But it's the same money.
Why? I'm not familiar with him. Like, what is his strategy that?
His strategy is, Jordan, you've been running Cardhook for 4 years. You're doing 50K in MRR. You did great. If you have any interest in selling, I'll write you a check for $1 million. You can walk away and, you know, great. Nice job. I will take that business into my portfolio. That $1 million that I bought it from, I will use my existing cash flow to get leverage, and I'll only put down 200K in cash and I'll finance the other 800K. And I just bought your business that makes 50K a month for $200,000 cash plus interest. And it's making 50K a month. I'm going to let my team that's already in-house run it. We're going to put it through our little marketing process. We're going to grow it and maintain it. And I'm going to make my money back in 18 months. And after that, I'm going to make a lot off of the investment.
Well, because he's able to look at it, yeah, as a pure, like almost
finance.
An annuity, right?
It's
so it's not, yeah, it's not like he's like, I'm at 50, like, I want to hire more staff. I want to get to 150 so I can hire these more people. And blah, blah. Like, he's just like, 50, great. I don't care if it doesn't really grow from there. Like, he wants it to grow, right? But even if it stays at 50, that's great. And he's going to be like 3 years out, it's all profit and it's $50,000. He's cashing a check and he's already got the team that pretty much manages them all. So they're not necessarily getting, some of them are getting work here and there, you know, but it's not like where you're on it full time every day. It's getting new features every day, all the time.
Yeah. You've got, managers in place.
So he's got people running it and doing support and whatever, but it's not that same like must have growth that a smaller bootstrapper might feel because you need to survive. It's just it's all on a spreadsheet, right? Like this is, the customers are happy. They're paying me every month.
Right. So here's the thing about JD Spot is the same thing that I was alluding to, although less clearly, was this opportunity in the bootstrap market. And that opportunity is going to grow. So JD's pie of potential acquisitions is just going to expand and expand and expand and expand. It's a very healthy.
Yeah, and there's a lot of SaaS apps that are never going to, because they're competing in tough markets, and they're just going to hit a ceiling because they don't have anything particularly special, and they'll get their niche and they'll make their 20 or 30,000 a month, and that's all they're ever going to be because they are competing with MailChimp or ConvertKit or whatever. You know, they're at a spot where they're not going to be able to differentiate enough or whatever. So,
and the founder gets tired, and here and there's JD.
Yeah. Hey, founders get tired. I've been tired.
Happened to me. You know?
It's hard to.
It took me a little while to get to the point. It was like, is selling this actually an option? And like, I think most founders at 10K, some may be thinking this, but it wasn't totally apparent to me that it was like, because I thought that I would just kind of grow to 10 or 20K and let it run on autopilot and start something new and build a portfolio of my own one by one. But without that cash leverage,
it's hard to do that.
Yeah. And then there's also the focus aspect of in like which market you're in. And it's just like at a certain point for many bootstrap founders, they just get to a point where it's worth more to me sold.
Yeah,
in terms of the leverage that I can have coming out of this to do the next thing.
And when it's your thing, you know, if you built three apps, you're too invested in those. Do you know what I mean? It's very different than if I just put money on it and I'm like, I own this now. It might go down. I'll write that off as a loss. I have another three. You know, it's just a different mindset than I killed myself for a year building this thing up. And now, oh, crap, it's going down. I gotta pay attention to that. Like, you know, whereas that's if it's just a loss, you're like, it's a
loss.
That's
why people view it negatively. That's why, because there's so much involved in it.
Yeah, there's a lot of heartache in there. If you're the one who built it, but if you know, from an investment perspective, you have to stand back from it, or else you're not really being a good investor. So, yeah, but I don't know. I don't think any of us have that cash flow yet. So maybe when we all come back in 2 years, we'll have the
good stuff. Well, this was cool. I think this was a good, good mix up on Bootstrap Web. I'm looking forward to future episodes. We're definitely going to be doing this for the next couple of weeks, so at least.
Nice. I'm looking forward to coming back.
Yeah, Ian, you'll be back, and
I'll be back.
Good stuff.
All right.
All right. Thanks
a lot, guys, for having me on.
Later.